Okay, welcome to Coin Talk. This is Aaron Lammer. I'll be joined shortly by my co-host, Jay Kang. A great show for you today. We got to talk to Peter Van Valkenburg from the Coin Center, which is kind of an advocacy. I don't know if they'd call themselves a lobbying group, but something along those strains. But before we get into that, I just want to say that this show is produced in partnership with Medium. They've got all kinds of great writing on Medium. Some of it is exclusively for the members, unlimited of all kinds of stuff, like the transcripts of this show, which are at medium.com/cointalk.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Sunday, March 5th at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was 11,498.
Jay, hello.
Hey, that was very enthusiastic.
This is how I roll at a late night taping. I sound like a rusty can of Diet Coke.
Are you excited that you are not watching the Oscars right now, which are going on?
I am excited.
Me too.
I am excited that I'm not watching the Oscars.
I always feel like social media kind of gaslights me into watching them. And every single year, I have not seen any of the movies, and I don't care who wins. And I sort of get not disgusted, but I would just say that I'm a little bit turned off, and then I feel bad about being turned off because I'm like, maybe I should stop taking myself so seriously and learn to enjoy this thing, but I never enjoy it.
I usually just think afterwards, oh, wow, I could have watched one movie while I was watching that. Like, I could have taken the most likely to be a good movie out of the list and watched that instead of watching the Oscars.
Or like six episodes of Atlanta or something like that.
What's been happening in the crypto world since we last talked? I feel like a lot of regulatory stuff.
Yeah, you know, we seem to be entering this strange space right now because, like, I think that a lot of the excitement after the run up to 19,000 and the fall back to 14,000 or so was run by alts booming every single day, and you have people signing up for exchange after exchange, and then you have Cryptopia coins just mooning every 6 hours, it felt like. And all that is dead now. And so I think that people are starting to have more serious conversations, I guess, about regulations, about what's going to happen in Washington. And so, you know, that
crypto's sobered up a little bit.
Yeah. And that's some of what we talked about with
cold bucket of water.
Yeah. And I think that our conversation with Peter was reflective of that. That there is a sort of, we all knew that this was going to come. We just didn't know how it was going to come, but we're starting to see the first, I guess, like hints of what regulation is going to look like in the crypto space.
It's kind of incredible that a currency that was defined by its decentralized nature, its anti-fiat, anti-banker narrative, is now, at least from a price level, being strongly influenced by U.S. government regulation and Wall Street interest.
Yeah, and, you know, they're trying to wrangle it, you know, and I don't think that anyone who is really reasonable or rational would say that that's not happening right now, and that it for a large portion or for a large part that they are successfully wrangling it, you know. So I guess I'm just waiting for the cypherpunks and the libertarians to do like an end around and try and bust this thing out of the increasing grasp of the government and Wall Street. But right now it does feel like it's almost an inevitable march down to some sort of real regulation and government control. What do you think?
Well, I remember when the Dread Pirate Roberts got caught. I don't know why. Did I have the right? Dread Pirate Roberts?
Yeah, DPR.
I don't know why it keeps. Yeah, DPR. And I remember I was actually talking to someone who was covering the case, a journalist. And my question was, if he had just not done this in the U.S., like if he hadn't lived in the U.S., would have he gotten away with this? Like, my strategy if I was doing something massively illegal would be like, go in the place that, you know, gives the least a shit about this.
Yeah.
And now I'm questioning, as the SEC starts to look into ICOs, what the real advantage of basing these companies in America is. Like, why even force the issue of American regulation?
Well, you know, as you know, but I don't think our listeners might not know, ICOs are already kind of regulated here in the United States. A lot of ICOs that get released abroad, you can't get them here. Like, you can't participate in them unless you VPN in. And so it's already
that's an interesting
it's
angle.
Already kind of a hostile place for ICOs.
Yeah, and I guess you're limiting your raise if you raise from Moldova and don't allow U.S. citizens to invest.
Yeah, and you also, you know, and I think this is probably the biggest thing, is that you are distancing yourself from Silicon Valley, which is where a lot of the energy and certainly most of the money would come for these sorts of ICOs. And so I think that's the concern.
So let's, before we get into some of the stuff that's been happening around ICOs, what in your estimation are ICOs? An ICO stands for initial coin offering. The beginning of many of these altcoins that we talk about on the show was that they were launched initially as an initial coin offering.
Well, yeah, this is a difficult question because I think that we can say things that it's not, but it's very easy.
Yeah.
It's a little bit harder to say what it is. I mean, I think very, very, very sort of basic. It is an offering of coins at a set price that launches much like an IPO does, where they say this is going to be the opening price. And then they build in all these incentives into it that make it feel a bit more casino-like, where you say, hey, if you're one of the first friends, 20 to 25 friends and family, then you get a 20% bonus or something like that. It's a fundraising mechanism for these currency blockchain companies where they will issue a currency, and the use of that currency is always it's always a little bit unknown,
opaque.
Yeah, they're like, you can use it on our platform. And you're like, your platform doesn't exist. Or like, why would I buy 1,000 of a currency on a platform that doesn't exist? And so that, I think, is really just sort of the fundamental. I don't know. You're not buying securities in a company. You're not buying equity in a company most of the time. You are literally just buying a token on a network, and your hope is that the network is used so much and that it becomes so popular that the token on the network then gains value because of supply and demand. That's about the basic idea.
Okay. So the first thing I feel like people who I've talked about ICOs, a big deal is that of these two biggest projects in all of crypto, Bitcoin and Ethereum, Bitcoin, not an ICO, Ethereum, an ICO. And Ethereum doesn't necessarily get grouped in with a lot of these later, shadier ICOs, but Ethereum was an ICO, right?
Yep.
In that universe that you describe of these utilities, what is the utility of Ethereum? It's to make smart contracts?
Well, the utility of Ethereum, I think, is that that it basically funded the ICO market. You know, you can't buy into ICOs without Ethereum, mostly. I mean, you especially if you're getting an ERC-20 token. So, for example, 0x, which is a token that I have dabbled in quite a bit, and it's one of the favorites, at least it was, I don't want to speak for him today, of Ledger Status, our friend and former guest.
I saw Ledger Status shilling a little Monero today, and
really?
I silently thanked him.
That's an ERC-20 token. It is built on the Ethereum network, and so the only way that they allow you to pay for the ERC-20 token is through Ethereum. And so basically Ethereum was used more or less to buy other tokens and other currencies. So that's why you would own Ethereum. Outside of that, I honestly don't know the other uses CryptoKitties or something.
No, I mean, that's reasonable enough. Ethereum is sort of the granddaddy, the app store of these kind of ventures, and other people have launched more niche ventures that are built on top of Ethereum. And now all of those ventures, by the very nature of launching as ICOs, are falling under the suspicious eye of American regulators.
Yeah, so that's this week's news. I think the biggest news that came out this week, which was that you know, it was written about in the Wall Street Journal and the Times and a lot of different places, which is that the SEC is going to start cracking down on ICOs. And that the first thing they did was they sent out dozens of subpoenas to tech companies and advisors. One guy who used to work at the SEC said that ICOs are the Wolf of Wall Street on steroids. And which I don't know. I mean, like, I don't even, it's like a mixed metaphor or something like that. I don't quite get it, but I do understand what he's saying. And then the last thing that I wanted to is that there's an MIT report coming out that says somewhere around $300 million last year at ICO fundraising went directly to things that are just obviously scams. And so that means that the SEC is going to really look into it. The biggest thing, I think that the biggest news that came out of all this is that Overstock.com, which is, you know, they have that CEO who's mega into crypto. And that they did their like T0 project, I think it's called, or they basically made an ICO outside of Overstock.com. That also is being investigated. So it goes up and down the chain. It's not just like tiny scam ICOs. It's also like, you know, a massive publicly traded company.
Yeah. So, I mean, the biggest difference, if I were to just describe like what's the difference between an ICO and an IPO, initial public offerings are usually for a company that's years old, has a product, revenue, an established team, established accounting practices, et cetera.
Yeah.
And even so, those are still regulated. So even something that just by nature of how long it's existed is more legitimate, is still regulated. So it does seem surprising, maybe, that ICOs have slipped under the radar up till now. And it's not like they've really slipped under the radar. They've just kind of gray areaed their way forward.
Yeah, I think it's more like also that like they've sprung up so quickly. So it's that you turn your back or you aren't paying attention and then you look over and there's like a shit ton of mushrooms that just popped up and you're like, whoa, yeah. Like, where did that come from? Maybe we should do something about that. So I think the vast majority of ICOs have come up in the last couple of years. So
have they indicated what particular elements of the ICO world they are trying to crack down? Like, what is the crackdown? Like, what's the part that won't fly anymore?
Well, I mean, look, this is always true. There's a lot of people on crypto Twitter or crypto experts being like, this is not a big deal. This is not a big deal. They only said that they're going to ask questions. And you're like, look, if they're sending out dozens of subpoenas, it's a thing, you know? I don't understand why people are sort of freaking out. I mean, I understand in the sense that they freak out over anything that's bad news. But look, cleaning up some of this ICO space seems pretty necessary to me. And I don't know. Look, I don't have that much faith in the SEC, or I don't love the SEC or anything like that. But I would think that if anybody was going to be able to rubber stamp this process and say these ICOs are okay, or this process, these should be the norms that you use, like, it's okay for me for that to come from the SEC, because I don't understand what the alternative would be other than like VPNing into Estonia and sending Ethereum to somebody who I have no idea if they're legitimate or not, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of this stuff comes back to my general preference for mined coins. Generally, in an ICO, you're basically just creating a bunch of value out of thin air, and then you're like, and I'm going to sell it for this much. But if you buy some now, you can get a 30% discount. And you, if you buy it even earlier, a 50% discount.
Yeah, I hate that.
And it's like, how is that possibly not going to be shady?
I hate like, that. I agree
with you. The very way that the Satoshi mining system is set up, people need to invest and mine Bitcoin and invest in the system and run nodes before the system can achieve any value. Any of these systems where the value is just implied from the beginning, I just don't really see what incentivizes people to actually follow through on any of the promises. They are rich as soon as the ICO happens. Even at the 50% discount level, you're still just printing money.
Yeah. Well, look, I totally agree with you, because it's like, I mean, the Can you imagine like what would happen if a actual company that had put in years of R&D and had like, you know, people dedicated to it, putting their own money in or putting in real investment dollars, spend years building an actual product, and they're like, you are the 49th person to buy our stock. You know, you get 20% more. Like
we say this is crazy. But this is actually what I think Goldman Sachs does in things like the Facebook IPO. They do offer preferential sales to preferential clients in such a way that they sell and then it spikes immediately. And the people who are able to pre-buy do get a good deal, I think. But they do it in a more elegant, time-honored way.
Or they do it in a more accepted and so shady way that like we don't know about it. I think there's just something about the like sort of like buy now bonanza part of ICOs that drives me crazy.
Yes. I mean, on the flip side, for you gamblers out there who are saying, how can I get in on some of that action? You know, ICOs, if you buy into an ICO and the product even happens, you've probably done very well. Because we're like talking about things that are coming out for a cent or fractions of a cent. And even if it's ever reaches a dime in value, you've made a 10, 100, 500-fold return. Not that I'm suggesting anyone get themselves involved in ICOs, but there's a reason why people are willing to gamble on things that look mostly like scams.
Yeah. Look, you know.
Jay, have you ever bought into an ICO?
No, but I thought about it last year, but now it just seems too shady. All right. So
I can see I feel like you would like do an ICO and then just like launch into like a decade long personal vendetta against the people who are like behind
tried to scam me. Exactly. Like, I like sent in a bunch of pitches being like, look, the only story I'm interested in writing is an investigative piece on Jambalcoin.
We don't know why you just keep wanting to investigate this one ICO.
Speaking of ICOs, one of the people who are getting into ICOs are countries. And we talked last time about PetroCoin, and we tried to make bets on who the next country would be. It turns out earlier this week that before you and I could even put out the odds, the Marshall Islands decided to put out a ICO and put out their own cryptocurrency, which worried me for a second. We talked about this a little bit on Twitter.
Because I had gone Caribbean nation, right?
Yeah.
In fact, you're more specific about it.
You said tax haven Caribbean nation.
Tax haven Caribbean nation. That only covers like 15 to 20 countries.
So when I saw the headline, it said tax haven Marshall Islands has issued their own cryptocurrency. Yes. And I was
Aaron won. Aaron's holding that ticket. Yeah. He's going to get my one Ripple. Yes. Now approaching a dollar again after cratering down to 60 cents or so.
Yeah. Well, it turns out the Marshall Islands are in the Pacific. And, you know, I actually...
Are the Marshall Islands where the action of the Thin Red Line takes place? And where am I making that up?
I have no idea. It's where they blew up like 60 atomic tests. I think the Marshall Islands coin actually is more interesting than the Petro coin in that it actually can be used as legal tender in the Marshall Islands. I don't know what that does for people like you or me, why we would buy Marshall Islands coin unless we were planning on going to the Marshall Islands. But you know what? It's cool that a country is actually using it.
Is part of the idea of this that people just deposit their money at the Marshall Islands anyway, and that rather than like leaving it in whatever currency you came with, you can like just stockpile ill-gotten gains and Marshall Islands coin?
I think that might be it, because you know it is called a tax haven for a reason. So I did this very quickly and I wanted to run it by you because
you've handicapped this race.
I've handicapped the third country to come out with their own
third country currency. Okay.
All right, so here they are. Isle of Man, I have at plus 180, which is if you bet $100, you win $180, right?
Okay. Wow.
Isle of Man is
very hard on the
most likely, I think.
Okay.
Channel Islands is at plus 225. That's one of your tax haven islands. The Cayman Islands is around the same odds at plus 250.
Classic of the genre.
Bermuda at plus 300. Luxembourg at plus 400, Monaco at plus 600.
I like Monaco at plus 600. We need a European like based crypto coin.
I kind of like Monaco too, because, you know, like, why do people go to Monaco? I mean, they go to Monaco to cut shady deals and to figure out how to launder money, right?
I mean, I was watching last night. My neighbor gave me this really old TV, uh-huh. and I had to try and get Netflix working on it to see if I could like stream anything. It has like the oldest Netflix ever, and it like took me forever to even like get to a movie that I wanted to like see if the picture looked right on.
Sure.
Finally, I got in Casino. Just watched all of Casino straight through. Stayed up way too late. But I was thinking while I was watching Casino, I was like, a lot of these problems would be solved with the cryptocurrency.
Exactly.
All this carrying of bags of money to mob bosses.
Well, that's the other thing. Monaco people go to go see, I think, F1 racing. They go to gamble. They go to make like shady deals.
Okay. I have a question about your odds, about your handicapping.
Yeah. Know.
Does Russian Ethereum count?
Well, Russian Ethereum, I think, is an inevitability, right? It's definitely coming.
Yeah. It's already been announced, I think. But it's not really quite the same thing as these national currencies, because as we were saying, Ethereum's actually a chain on which further projects are then issued rather than a spendable currency by nature, although you can spend Ethereum. So,
I mean,
you
know, I think it would count, but it's already been announced. And also, I think that they are trying to make as much as we can say Russia is trying to make a good faith effort, I do think that what they're trying to do is make a good faith effort at what China did with Facebook and messaging apps, and just try and build their own version of this so that they don't have to, you know, go ask their, was Vitalik born in Russia? I think he was, or at least his parents were.
I believe he was. They
don't have to go ask Vitalik to like denounce his Canadian citizenship and come live in Russia. So I think they're just trying to build their own. So it's a little bit, it's not quite like Petrocoin, I think, where it's just like a country is deciding to do a scam.
Okay, while we're on this topic.
Yeah.
This is something, you know, so already as we started discussing ICOs, we've like sort of weaved our way like through Ethereum to some like ICOs that are just coming out, like Petro and potentially Marshall Islands coin. You're already like all kinds of different places. And I had an experience today that I wanted to ask you about psychologically.
Okay.
As a crypto, you know, a lot of like the reason I think alts kind of can capture people's interest, it's just there's like so many of them, there's endless intrigue and endless confusion, and so like it was someone talking, and it was a guy I respect on Twitter. He was saying, look, I'm, you know, as a trained computer scientist, blah 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 blah,
yeah,
basically started writing about Neo. He like got pretty deep into Neo. Neo is sort of known as the Chinese Ethereum, although unlike the Russian Ethereum, I don't think it has official government connections.
No, it's Trithereum, but yes. it's like Ethereum in China. Yeah.
And formerly AntShares. And he basically like took Neo apart and was like, this is a total joke of a project. None of this shit works. You can go online.
I think I read
it. The specifics aren't really like, yeah, you read it.
Yeah.
The specifics aren't really that important, other than they're like convincing, and I have no way myself to interrogate them. And I was thinking back in my first few months in the coin world, and yeah. I was like, this happened to me constantly. You will find someone who is debunking Ethereum. You will find someone who says, I know this, and this about the Bitcoin network, and that's why scaling will never work, and this whole thing's doomed, blah 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 blah. How do you react to these kind of like well-reasoned meltdown kind of arguments?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it depends, I think. I mean, I think that it's just hard to figure out what people's incentives are, you know? I mean,
you're going straight to like, What is he really telling you this
well,
for?
Well, because
maybe
like,
he's loading up his Neo bags.
Well, I don't think that, but I do think that, look, we see this all the time in the fork debates, right? We saw it around Bitcoin Cash. We saw it around 2X, right, where people go on these impassioned rants. And there's, if you look at their past, you're just like, oh, well, this person clearly knows what they're talking about, you know? But everything feels so... there's no like middle ground. There's no reasonable take out there. everything's either a complete scam, you know, or all the way down to like that guy who only eats meat, one of the meat eaters who like says Ethereum is also like a shit coin and everything except Bitcoin is a shit coin. So you have that level, but you don't really have anything. You only really have variations of that level, you know? Like, obviously, some people are more into different alts and more. Some people have bigger tents for it. But anything that's not in their tent is, like, a complete scam. And I do think that I have a hard time.
See, I get the political intrigue. The political intrigue makes perfect sense to me because I've been watching people fucking shit on each other on the internet for 20 years.
Yeah.
And, like, some things don't change. But the sort of technical know-how and the sort of rigorous computer science blockchain level takedowns, those ones are sometimes harder for me to swallow. I guess like it's no accident that there's this sort of thin veneer of scientificness to white papers. Yeah. And when someone is convincingly like this technology does not work, that will often cause me like to blink a little bit harder than when like, someone will say, oh, like Bitcoin's going to $0 because of Tether fraud. I'm like, oh, I understand fraud. I understand con men. I get all that stuff. I get financial fraudism. What I can't quite refute is like a well-reasoned argument that the technology has like a king has no clothes element. And I don't mean the whole thing. I mean like a specific project like Neo, which is, I think, a top 10 project right now. And we've already probably talked on the show about half of the top 10 coins being potentially not even workable.
Yeah, well, the problem with Neo is that it only has like 7 nodes or something, right? That it's very centralized. And that like voting within the community really is very limited to like the people who run the central program. So that actually...
Much like Ripple.
That makes sense to me in the sense that people will... get up, you know, that that is actually a tech problem that I can put my brain around, and it's not new. I mean, like you and I talked about this, I think, on a basement tape about Neo, like months ago. You know, where
a lot of demand out there for the basement tapes. Talk to some young gentlemen today from the Los Angeles Review of Books.
They want the basement. They do not want the basement.
Well,
tapes.
No, they're writing the podcast review. It'll be coming out. Shouts to those guys. But they were like, they knew about the basement. They were asking about the basement tapes. And I was like, look, people ask me every day, release the basement tapes. And I won't do it until Jay's dead.
Oh, man. That's a very common theme in my life right now is for people to people demanding that I release the full audio of something. But,
yeah, release right. Jay. Why did you edit those basement tapes?
Yeah, why did you edit those?
Where are the missing basement tapes? Yeah.
Why does Aaron seem so mad during this basement tape? You must have provoked him somehow. Did you kick him?
Yeah. So I mean, look, we're gonna have to just get used to people terrifying us with scary technical assessments of various coins, right on up to Bitcoin, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think that what you're talking about is very real. Like there is sort of a layer of unknowing, right? And in much like any sort of propagandist enterprise where there is no actual like solid truth because nobody really knows that much, and the things that we do know are shrouded in sort of a sketchy fog. I don't know if fog can be sketchy, but and so that any compelling case that sounds right is going to sound right, you know?
I think that's right. Like, I think it's like that's a good addendum to our like none of this is investment advice weekly reminder. This is all, what did you say? Shrouded in a thick fog.
Sketchy fog.
Yeah, I would say all the information presented on the show should be regarded as having a sketchy fog wafting across it at all times, because I don't believe everything's a scam, but I do believe some shocking things are going to come out.
Yeah, and you know, I think that of any space I've been in, and I think that Twitter is obviously very powerful in politics and media.
Yeah,
but in crypto, it really can sort of move mountains, and I'm sure that
it's
like,
a small world.
Yeah,
like there's like probably like 1,000 people who really are moving these markets. And then there's just like a lot of people on Twitter who are just like
pumping ETC,
selling, pumping, who knows what's happening. Yeah. Okay, right, so should we do this interview with Peter?
Yeah, yeah, let's talk to him. It's good conversation.
Good conversation. Before I go and we play the interview, how you feeling about your bags here going into the next week?
Well, I sold a bunch between 9,600 and 10,500. I sold some at 11,400. And so I'm exiting because I'm not sure if I own almost no alts, so it's really just Bitcoin. I'm not sure if we're gonna get above that without crashing. And the only reason I think that is because we seem to have a pretty decent rate of crashing, and just time wise, like there's a rhythm to it, yep. And it seems like we're kind of due for one right now.
I mean, we've both talked about this 11,500 target here, where it just kind of keeps running up and bumping up close to there.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the sort of crucial line. So I'm just holding where I am. I'm just absolutely doing nothing because I have absolutely no idea what's going to happen next. And I feel like changing anything I'm doing would be completely 50-50.
Yeah.
I'm definitely waiting for something to happen. I don't think we will just like stick here for long. So I would probably like to get out of Ubik, which I believe you did presciently. That's probably like the main thing I'm trying to do is like eliminate a few of these alts, but without like feeling like I sold them right before they spiked, which I do think could happen here. I mean, we have in some ways been lingering around Bitcoin at the same price for a while. I don't fucking know. I don't believe in any of this shit anymore. Do you?
No. That's why I'm basically selling to gamble, because I think if it crashes, then I'll have more Bitcoin. I'm not selling to be more prudent.
I have no idea what's going to happen next.
All right. Well,
feeling good about Monero though. I'm feeling strong. Ledger, he big upped the Monero today, and it gave me a surge of confidence.
That's good.
All right, let's talk to Peter.
Okay, cool.
All right, so our guest today is Peter Van Valkenburg. He is the director of research at Coin Center, which is a nonprofit research and advocacy group that's focused on public policy issues facing cryptocurrency. Peter, did I get all that right?
Yeah, spot on.
That was so formal, Jay.
We're trying to professionalize the show.
This is just a casual chat. what is the Coin Center in a like? You are on a airplane with someone who is maybe not even familiar with cryptocurrencies. Like, what is it all? What does it mean?
Well, if I'm on an airplane, I'm not telling them anything about Coin Center because the conversation could potentially last the entire flight at this point. but if they're going to ask what Coin Center is, we have an elevator pitch. It's going to be kind of like regrettably formal as well, but we are an independent nonprofit research and advocacy group based in Washington, D.C., and we're focused on the public policy issues, so government policy issues that arise with the emergence of cryptocurrencies and open blockchain networks. So those would be things like Bitcoin, Ethereum, Zcash, anything with an open consensus mechanism. Now, if I'm on an airplane and I just said open consensus mechanism, I'm asking for problems. But hopefully that means something to your listeners.
Yeah. I think what are the government and policy concerns then right now? Because I imagine that they've changed over the amount of time that you've been working in this space. So, like, you know, we just had these widely publicized Senate hearings. We've had a lot of people from the CFTC and the SEC weigh in on Bitcoin. So like what is the state of I would say the policy realm right now?
Yeah, you're absolutely right that they've evolved. And the hearing in front of the Senate Banking Committee, where Chairman Giancarlo of the CFTC and Chairman Clayton of the SEC, is pretty indicative of where they've headed. They've headed into the realm of the federal government looking at investor protection. And the two on point agencies there are the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, which regulates, derivative financial products where the underlying is a commodity. And they've said, look, the commodity that underlies a swap or future could be a Bitcoin. And so we're going to regulate for investor protection and for market transparency and things like that. And the SEC has jurisdiction not over commodity investments, but investments in securities, which are possibly some cryptocurrencies, altcoins or token projects, especially when, you know, just to give the strictures of the test, it's there's an investment of money with an expectation of profits into a common enterprise where we rely on a third party or promoter to realize those profits. And what that means is not that these things are illegal, of course. It just means that they have to comply with securities laws, which means registering to have an IPO, which includes audited financials and some really expensive lawyering and some other things. Or maybe you fit into a safe harbor in the securities laws.
I'm sorry, like how?
Please interrupt me.
No.
I think this elevator is broken.
All right, so my question is like, all right, so you are, there are people in the Senate who now have heard this, have talked about Bitcoin, right? And we know that from Sarah Huckabee Sanders, in the one time she mentioned Bitcoin, is that the president is looking into it. But I think we can safely assume, Aaron and I being people who know a small amount of Bitcoin, but not that much, but who talk to people all the time that know nothing about Bitcoin, that the vast majority of people in Washington probably know nothing about this stuff.
Man, like, I just thought of the most viral story possible.
What is that?
Donald Trump revealed as a massive Bitcoin whale.
Yeah, it would be like 50 Cent times like 500.
You catch the internet on fire with that story.
People with every person who hates Donald Trump would start dumping immediately just to bankrupt his stock. But like, how do you get senators, congressmen, people in Washington up to speed on like the crypto space?
Yeah, and that's actually the primary thing that we do at Coin Center. So we've developed a lot of research about things like how commodities laws or securities laws intersect with the technology to try and have a sensible approach. But that's actually secondary to our main objective, which is to just be the voice for these technologies in Washington, D.C., and hopefully an unbiased voice that is optimistic about how these technologies can do good in the world. You know, the internet is a fundamental infrastructure that's incredibly important to our lives. We're conversing over it right now. This podcast will go out over it. People use it for everything. And it has independent advocates in D.C. There's like great organizations like the Center for Democracy and Technology or the Electronic Frontier Foundation that are nonprofits like we are, that have just one mission, which is to educate people in government about how these things work so that they don't make lousy decisions. And so our day-to-day is actually usually having briefings to explain how Bitcoin works, to explain how Ethereum works or tokens or cryptocurrencies in general, and allay their concerns, because there are actually usually a lot of concerns that can be allayed. Like, for example, if you read the headlines, especially years ago, but even today, Bitcoin was always mentioned as the anonymous cryptocurrency of the dark web. And there might be some kernel of like reality to that, in that, yes, cryptocurrencies have been used on the dark web, like the Silk Road and drug sites like that. But there's a big problem with calling it anonymous. It's not anonymous at all.
It's not fair to Monero.
Yeah. And even Monero is not necessarily anonymous. There's a lot of forensic accounting you can do and police work you can do to identify users of these systems. And so the fears are often overblown. The hype is often too extreme. Ideally, Coin Center is the reasonable voice that someone in government can call when they want an unbiased explanation of how the tech works and they want to learn the moving parts and maybe how some of their laws or regulations intersect with this new network.
Do you consider it your job at the Coin Center to promote and educate people about all forms of cryptocurrency, or is there like I would think that Bitcoin is so different than a no-name shitcoin ICO that launched a week ago, and you're walking in there. Are you drawing distinctions between these projects are probably like going to be good for America and investors, and these projects are probably going to be bad? Like, how do you avoid taking sides when you're explaining all of this stuff?
Yeah, and it is very important that we don't take sides. We try very aggressively to be as coin agnostic as possible. Where we do discriminate is between technologies that have an open consensus mechanism, like I mentioned earlier.
Yeah. Does that include like Ripple?
Yeah. Can you explain what that is? Just maybe a little more in layman's term.
Yeah.
We would say for the audience, but actually for me and Aaron.
What I'd say is this. if anybody can utilize the network to achieve some sort of functionality, so like you can set up an address and receive payments in some sort of asset native to the network, and you can do that without going through a licensing process or an identification process where you get permission from some sort of coordinating central authority to join the network and set up that address or be a node on it or interact with it. That's one criteria. But I'd also say that it's more than just being able to receive the functionality of the network. You have to be a part of the actual infrastructure.
So what are some examples of projects that are not open?
At core, we're talking about consensus, right? We're talking about getting a bunch of computers to agree over some socially important data. And most of those consensus algorithms, they keep all of the several computers on the network in sync by having a leader election. And, you know, Bitcoin actually has something like a leader election. Every 10 minutes, a new leader is picked to set the authoritative list of transactions for that period. But it's picked through an open process. Previous to Bitcoin, all consensus mechanisms would have leader elections. In other words, one computer on the network gets picked to be authoritative for a period of time, and then we switch. But the way that they were picked was used through something like a round robin. Sure. Like first this computer goes, then this computer goes, then this computer goes. And you get to earn a place in line in the round robin by being previously provisioned with a public-private key pair. So you authenticate yourself to the rest of the network. The rest of the network only listens to things from the preordained key pairs, and that's how you keep the whole thing fault tolerant, is by gating it or permissioning it. So any consensus-driven network where the nodes have to authenticate using a previously provisioned key, which they're going to get from the central authority, is what I would call a closed or not open blockchain technology. And they may not even have blockchains. It's just we use the term blockchain technology because it's hot.
Okay, so when you go to when a senator calls you, right?
We don't talk like this.
Or a congressman calls you.
You ask me a pretty nuanced question.
How much time do you have?
let's say a congressman is calling you and they're like, listen, my pal Warren Buffett has said that he doesn't really know that much about Bitcoin, but my other pal Jamie Dimon says that he thinks it's bad. What can you tell me about this thing? Like, I guess I have two questions. The first is, how much does your average person in the government know about Bitcoin right now or cryptocurrencies? And secondly, like, how do you sort of onboard them onto this is a good idea, given that the people that they generally talk to, I would think, are either afraid of it or they're a little bit, or at least they're wary of it?
Yeah. So a few things. First, it's important to differentiate between people who are in the government because they're politicians who make law.
Sure, let's talk
Congress.
About politicians then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And regulators was the other category I was going to say, who enforce the law.
But so what about your elected official, like your average elected official? How much do they know?
Yeah. So then it's going to depend on the office and whether the senator or the representative has taken an interest. We find a few who are highly sophisticated because they may have a technology background. So take Jared Polis of Colorado as an example. He's a guy who, before he went to politics, started an ISP. So he's an old internet entrepreneur.
He's also on the cannabis caucus.
Yeah.
Overlap
and he's
with
a
my
gamer.
Interest. He's a gamer? Holy
shit. Yeah, he does massive multiplayer.
Maybe he
games.
Should be coin daddy.
I think he should be president. I don't know. But and Jared Polis actually co-founded the Blockchain Caucus, which we've done a lot of work with. So it's just a group of congressmen in the House who want to talk about blockchain. So he gets it. And then at the other end of the extreme, you have, I won't name any names, but usually older representatives who, may not even be interested or knowledgeable about the internet. And so when you come to them and you start talking about cryptocurrencies that are powered by peer-to-peer networking, cryptography, and economic incentives, you're going to have to slow down and start really at the beginning.
All right, so you don't have to name any names, but if you do, then feel free. Like we don't have to put it pejoratively, but what was the most basic question that you've gotten from an elected official?
What makes Bitcoin valuable?
Hmm.
Maybe I'm maybe it's I'm biased because I did econ before law school. But the question of value is not a sensible question. No, it's not, because everything is worth what people are willing to pay for it. And that is something that usually boils down to how much of it is in the world and capable of exclusive ownership or possession, and how many people want it. So it's supply and demand. And this is, I don't know, this is something that a lot of people have trouble with. So even if maybe they understand that there's only 21 million Bitcoins and that there are exchanges where people buy and sell them, you might still get the question, yeah, but why is this, who sets the price?
Yeah, there seems to be this weird cognitive block that people have, which is that, and I remember that I was reading somebody who was writing about it who will, you know, also remain nameless, but he was saying that, look, gold can be used for filling teeth, and even tulips, because he was using the sort of overused tulip mania example, even tulips you can plant in the ground and there's a flower, but Bitcoin, there's nothing that you can use it for. But, like, you know, it seems strange because, you know, you do have these things like baseball cards. Like, what actually is a baseball card? It's like a tiny piece of cardboard, you know?
A piece of art?
Where, like, the difference for them, I think, is in, like, sort of something that you can hold in your hand and something that exists entirely on the internet, which, you know, flies in the face of the fact that the vast majority of these people, regardless of how old they are, live the majority of their lives on some sort of network or another.
Yeah. So, like, and how do you look at their net worth and it's all in their 401k.
Yeah. It's all like, there's no like vault at E-Trade that I can go to and be like, okay, I'm going to need all the promissory notes from all these these penny stocks that I bought.
And you know, And so I'm agreeing with you that, like, this idea that things need to have intrinsic value to have value is silly, because everything just has subjective value, and things, you know, things are valuable because you like it. And if enough people like it, they're socially valuable and they have a price. But I would also add that Bitcoin is useful, and it's impossible to deny that it's useful, because when you have a Bitcoin, you have a unique capability on the internet. If you have a Bitcoin, you can write a message, which is a certain string of characters, and sign a transaction that will end up in the blockchain. And if it ends up in the blockchain, everyone will see it and honor it, everyone else on the network. That is a unique capability that you have to have a Bitcoin to have. You can't just send Bitcoins before you've received them. You have to get them first, and then you actually have some utility. You can make a public transaction that everyone will put faith in, because they put faith in the entire Bitcoin platform as a technology, not as a shared delusion, but as an actual system for record keeping that has this requirement. You need a Bitcoin in order to send a Bitcoin.
In terms of regulations, because I think that is something that you've spoken about before, you know, whether to the press, or I'm sure it's something that you talk a lot about. If you look at the Bitcoin community, which is something that Aaron and I are starting to dip our toes into, you find a lot of people who are very, very, very strident about the idea that, like, regulation, any type of regulation is bad, you know? So you have, like, Roger Ver going on CNBC and saying insider trading is good, you know?
Should be legal.
And you have a lot of people who sort of ascribe to a Austrian school of economics type of mentality where they believe that, like, you know, it's sort of this anarcho-capitalism. I would imagine that you and your role need a more measured approach, and that if you are talking to senators or people like that, where if they hear the phrase insider trading is good, they'll be like, okay, I need you to leave my office right now.
Go back to the,
like,
Caribbean, you.
Exactly. There's a boat to St. Kitts leaving. What are good regulations and what are bad regulations for crypto right now, in your opinion?
Yeah, and you know, so Coin Center is non-ideological in the sense that you're describing. What we're mostly focused on is pragmatism. We like this technology. That's the maybe ideological part. It's an affinity towards open blockchain networks. And we want to see it have the room to succeed. But that doesn't mean that we have to get rid of government or something like that. I think it means that we can work to stop really bad policies from emerging. Like in other countries, not in the US, you see semi-earnest attempts to actually just ban the technology. And I think that'd be unconstitutional. It would violate free speech and some other things in our constitution. But it's also not necessarily on the horizon. But that would be one of the primary objectives, would be to stop bad policy like that. And then with regard to regulating other, you know, other regulations don't actually regulate the technology. Unless you're talking about a ban on the technology, we're talking about people regulating certain individuals when they do certain activities using the technology. And so, for example, one of those activities might be, I'm going to start a business, and it's going to be a node on the blockchain, but a very special node where I will advertise, hey, use my node in order to set up your wallet and store your Bitcoin and write your transactions for you. In other words, I'm going to be a hosted wallet provider. I'm going to hold people's Bitcoins for them. They're not going to interact with the network directly. They're going to interact through me. You are in a position of trust. You could be like Mt. Gox and have lousy cybersecurity and get hacked and lose those funds. And you're also, by the way, a lot like PayPal or Venmo, where we rely on their honesty, integrity, and cybersecurity to not lose our dollar balances that we keep in our PayPal wallet. So what this means is, if we regulate an activity like holding other people's valuables with respect to PayPal and dollars, then maybe it's not insane to regulate the same activity when it's a person holding other people's Bitcoins for them. It'd be great if we had more common sense ways to regulate those custodians. So like one of the big problems in the US is if you're a custodian like that, you have to get a money transmission license in every state where you have customers. And that means you need to get a background check and maybe fingerprinted in 53 states and territories, even though the 53rd background check and fingerprinting is not going to make customers safer. So there's bad things about money transmission licensing that we can reason about and advocate for improvements. But the basic premise that somehow because you're holding people's Bitcoins for them in a trusted relationship instead of holding people's dollars in a trusted relationship, and therefore because they're magical blockchain tokens, you shouldn't be regulated as a trusted custodian. I don't understand the coherence there. Now, maybe you're just against all regulation and that's fine. But in that case, you're not even advocating for Bitcoin. You're advocating for revolution. Well, and really those people, if they're ideologically pure, should also be against, and some of them maybe are, but they should also be against hosted wallet providers.
Yeah, they are.
Like mountain men who live out in the wilderness and will validate every transaction that comes across their machine and have at least three computers running since 2008.
Yeah, I think yeah, they want basically like a battery powered like a bicycle that powers a battery that powers a node.
And you know, actually, I like that there are those mountain men out there. I hope that they're out there. And
well, the problem
I don't want
for them is that they all also use Coinbase. They're like, everyone else's Coinbase account is bad except for mine, you know? And I only use it. I only use it to onboard fiat, but they shouldn't be regulated. I mean, I do think
the
that
other funny thing about these people, some of them, is if they're Bitcoin maximalists. And again, Coin Center tries really hard to be coin agnostic. And sometimes we get in the middle of like a fight between a Bitcoin purist and an Ethereum person, and I just get headaches. If they're a Bitcoin maximalist and one of these anti-government people, I've seen people with a straight face say it's immoral to regulate Bitcoin, and the SEC should go after, you know, this token sale because it's a shitcoin.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot.
It's just the height of hypocrisy. Yeah. I don't know.
All the way to like Ethereum. Ethereum should be illegal, but Bitcoin should not be regulated in any sense.
And there should be no laws.
What was your background? Like what were your first experiences in crypto? How did you end up running something like this?
So I'm the director of research, just to be clear. I don't run it. Jerry.
How did you end up running the research?
So my background was, a long time ago, I was trying to be a working actor in New York City, which meant I didn't have any money, which meant that I could either wait tables or tend bar like all my friends did, or I could teach myself web design and have all my friends pay me to set up their websites, which is what I did. And that got me into...
If you're anything like me, those people are still emailing you saying, hey, my website's down 15 years yep. later.
Yeah, it's the most thankless, like crappy sysadmin type and not even sysadmin, but crappy job you could possibly do. But it was better than waiting tables, actually, I think. So that got me into really lousy front-end coding, and I'm just absolute pants at anything that involves like serious back-end or real computer programming. And so I think I realized my limitations, and I decided I should get a real degree and get a real job. And I don't think I can do comp sci, unfortunately, even though I really like the tech and I really like the internet. And so I decided ultimately to go to get a degree in economics from George Mason and then a degree in law from NYU. And when I was at NYU, a friend of mine told me about Bitcoin. I still have the Google Hangouts chat history, and I can calculate how many years I ignored that conversation to my peril.
You know exactly what the price of Bitcoin was at the moment that Google Hangout occurred?
Yeah, it was about $11. and so I thought, oh, well, this is something I could write about academically.
What is, it's a final question here, what's the biggest policy hurdle for crypto in this upcoming year? Like what could happen, or what won't happen that you think could really hamper the space?
Jay loves a doomsday scenario.
Yeah. So the state-by-state money transmission licensing thing is still a real problem. It's a huge barrier to entry. If you're going to put yourself in a position of trust with respect to your customer's cryptocurrency, you're going to have to get licensed in a whole bunch of states, and it's going to be really expensive.
Okay, so just to clarify for our listeners here, you're clarifying about something like Robinhood, which just opened crypto but only opened in 5 states. So it's that to run an exchange or run something where you use Bitcoin, you need 53 separate.
That's why we
licenses.
Never get any of the fun stuff in New York.
Yeah, in New York. All right, so go ahead. Right. I'm sorry. Yep.
And you know, Robinhood might already have licenses, and Square, which Square Cash added Bitcoin recently, definitely has licenses in all the states, but they still often have to go to every one of their state regulators and explain why they want to add Bitcoin to the platform and explain why that isn't going to make them forfeit their license or shouldn't make them forfeit their license. So it's just a nonsensical regime for internet payment companies, whether they're cryptocurrency companies or whether they're PayPal or Venmo. We should have a federal regulatory framework that's still light touch, that doesn't make it really hard to get a license, and means that you'll only have to get one rather than 53 state and territory licenses. So optimistically, maybe we see some federal preemption of state law overturning that policy. That's probably too much to hope for this year, but maybe that happens. And if it doesn't happen, that is a real impediment to the technology. And then the other thing I'd say is, it's true, the SEC and the CFTC are taking a really hard look now at tokens, token sales, and cryptocurrencies. And a lot of token sales have not been compliant with the securities laws. And I think a lot of them have even been non-compliant while knowing that they're non-compliant. Like, they didn't have a good faith excuse. Like, they started selling them long after the SEC had come out pretty clearly and said, hey, these things are securities, and they just kind of ignored U.S.
They
laws.
They even violate now, scammer law.
They even violate plagiarism restrictions.
And so the real danger, and I don't hold much water for the more fly-by-night ICOs. I don't hold any water at all, especially the scams, because there are Ponzi scams too. But I really do worry that if this gets bad, like even worse than it is, and like grandma and grandpa bought shitcoin at whatever, and now they've lost their entire pension or their life savings or whatever, that these investment protection regulators, especially the SEC, will look at that and feel pressure from Congress and from everyone else to take a strong response that is not only calibrated at stopping those kinds of scammy token sale things, but maybe also makes it extremely difficult for anybody to get involved with legitimate or like well-established cryptocurrencies. And that I do worry about. So building
it's
gonna
a
kind
down
of
to
wall
two podcast
of separation
hosts. Who held too much sumo coin? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
No, it's fine. I was going to say, like priority for us is to really hit home that there are ICOs, which are one thing, and then there are cryptocurrencies, which are something else. And Chairman Clayton actually said that in his testimony before the Senate Banking Committee. He said there are pure cryptocurrencies, which makes them sound really cool, and then there are ICOs, and ICOs are securities. But that separation needs to be maintained and bolstered, at least in the minds of policymakers, because it's reasonable and important.
Do you hold coins yourself? Is there any sort of like a restriction on that in this job or not?
No, I don't, you know, I mean, I feel like it would be odd to
skin in the
game,
maybe.
If you were in the oil and gas industry and you were working at a nonprofit that advocates for sensible regulation of oil and gas companies, which you know, there are, I imagine, doesn't mean you can't own some oil and maybe you only own natural gas, but not oil. And people are like, are you only going to advocate for good policy towards natural gas mines? That seems fairly remote. And I do own probably 20 different cryptocurrencies and or tokens.
Well, you and Aaron are in good company.
Okay, then. Give our listeners what's one project you're excited about that people might not know about?
Oh, I don't know if I should do that,
though. I almost got you to do it.
It starts to go to my, because this is, more of an official Coin Center interview. I don't think I can actually.
Okay, you can tell us off air.
thanks for coming on today, Peter. If people want to follow you or learn about Coin Center, where should they go?
So all of our advocacy materials are on our website, coincenter.org, and you'll find long-form reports on securities laws, and you'll find short-form blog posts about what our work is looking like at any given day or week.
Great.
Great. We'd love to have you back on the show sometime if some of this stuff comes full circle and mom and pop do get lose their retirement savings. Let's pick up
mom
the thread
and pop
there.
Being me and Aaron.
Yeah, me and Dan.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks. Later.
All right, bye.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Sunday, March 5th at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was 11,498.
Thanks for listening to Coin Talk. I'm Aaron Lammer. My co-host is, of course, Jay Kang. This episode was edited by Carolyn Lester. Our partner is Medium. You can find every episode, including a transcript, at medium.com/cointalk. You can get in touch with us, hi@cointalk.show. If you're not following us on Twitter or Instagram, both are at @cointalkshow. We're posting more and more stuff. We're bringing in people to start working on that. So I think it's worth a follow if you get into those formats. CoinTalk does not come out on a totally regular schedule. That is because we are trying to catch these crypto news cycles. Jay and I are both on the road this week, so I'm not exactly sure when the next episode will come out, but keep tuned. We will get it out to you as soon as we can. And keep emailing us suggestions for guests. We've gotten some really good ones. Again, hi@cointalk.show. See you soon.